Star Wars, Heir to the Empire, by Timothy Zahn. Continued. Cassette number 5, side 2. All right, he said. Assuming we don't wind up playing tag with a Star Destroyer or two. Right, Lando agreed soberly. The last thing we want is to draw the Imperials onto Carda's tail. We've got enough enemies out there as it is. He tapped the ship's intercom switch. 3PO, you there? Of course, Leia's voice returned. Come on up here, Lando told the droid. Time for your debut performance. The corridor was filled with sculptures instead of pictures this time. Over 100 of them, lining the walls in holographic niches, as well as scattered around the floor on ornate pedestals. The variety, as Pelion had come to expect, was astonishing, ranging from human-style chunks of simple stone and wood to others that were more like tethered living creatures than works of art. Each was illuminated by a hazy globe of light, giving sharp contrast to the darkness of the spaces between them. Admiral? Pelion called uncertainly, trying to see around the artwork and through the gloom. Come in, Captain, Thrawn's coolly modulated voice beckoned. Over at the command chair, just above the hazy white of the Grand Admiral's uniform, two glowing red slits appeared. You have something? Yes, sir, Pelion told him, walking to the console ring and handing a data card over it. One of our probes in the outer Athiga system has picked up Skywalker and his companions. And his companions, Thrawn echoed thoughtfully. He took the data card, inserted it, and for a minute watched the replay in silence. Interesting, he murmured. Interesting, indeed. What's that third ship, the one maneuvering to link with the Millennium Falcon's dorsal hatch? We've tentatively identified it as the Lady Luck, Pelion said. Administrator Lando Calrissian's personal ship. One of the other probes copied a transmission stating that Calrissian was leaving Unkion on a purchasing trip. Do we know that Calrissian did, in fact, board the ship at Unkion? No, sir, not for certain. We can try to get that information, though. Unnecessary, Thrawn said. Our enemies are clearly past the stage of such childish tricks. Thrawn pointed to the display where the Millennium Falcon and the Lady Luck were now joined together. Observe, Captain, their strategy. Captain Solo and his wife, and probably the Wookiee Chewbacca, board their ship on Keon, while Calrissian similarly boards his. They fly to the outer Athiga system, and there they make a switch. Pelion frowned. But we've... Shh! Thrawn cut him off sharply, holding up a finger for silence, his eyes on the display. Pelion watched, too, as absolutely nothing happened. After a few minutes, the two ships separated, maneuvering carefully away from each other. Excellent, Thrawn said, freezing the frame. 4 minutes, 53 seconds. They're in a hurry, of course, locked together so vulnerably, which means... His forehead furrowed in concentration, then cleared. 3 people, he said, a touch of satisfaction in his voice. 3 people transferred, in one direction or the other, between those 2 ships. Yes, sir, Pelion nodded, wondering how in the Empire the Grand Admiral had figured that one out. At any rate, we know that Leia Organa Solo remained aboard the Millennium Falcon. Do we? Thrawn asked, lazily polite. Do we indeed? I believe we do, sir, yes, Pelion said, quietly insistent. The Grand Admiral hadn't seen the entire playback after all. Right after the Lady Luck and Skywalker's X-Wing left, we intercepted a transmission from her that definitely originated from the Millennium Falcon. Thrawn shook his head. "A recording," he said, his voice leaving no room for argument. "No, they're cleverer than that. A voice print doctored droid, then. Probably Skywalker's 3PO protocol droid. Leia Organa Solo, you see, was one of the two people who left with the Lady Luck." Pelion looked at the display. "I don't understand." "Consider the possibilities," Thrawn said, leaning back in his chair and steepling his fingertips in front of him. "Three people start out aboard the Millennium Falcon, one aboard the Lady Luck. Three people then transfer, but neither Solo nor Calrissian is the type to turn his ship over to the dubious command of a computer or droid. So each ship must end up with at least one person aboard. You follow so far?" "Yes, sir," Pelion said. "That doesn't tell us who is where, though." "Patience, Captain," Thrawn interrupted him. "Patience. As you say, the question now is that of the final makeup of the crews. Fortunately, once we know there were three transfers, there are only two possible combinations. Either Solo and Organa Solo are together aboard the Lady Luck, or else Organa Solo and the Wookiee are there. Unless one of the transfers was a droid," Pelion pointed out. "Unlikely," Thrawn shook his head. "Historically, Solo has never liked droids, nor allowed them to travel aboard his ship, except under highly unusual circumstances. Skywalker's droid and its astromech counterpart appear to be the sole exceptions. And thanks to your transmission data, we already know that the droid has remained on the Millennium Falcon." "Yes, sir," Pelion said, not entirely convinced, but knowing better than to argue the point. "Shall I put out an alert on the Lady Luck, then?" "That won't be necessary," Thrawn said. And this time the satisfaction came through clearly. "I know exactly where Leia Organa Solo is going." Pelion stared at him. "You're not serious, sir." "Perfectly serious, Captain," Thrawn said evenly. "Consider. Solo and Organa Solo have nothing to gain by simply transferring together to the Lady Luck. The Millennium Falcon is faster and far better defended. This exercise only makes sense if Organa Solo and the Wookiee are together." Thrawn smiled up at Pelion. "And given that, there is only one logical place for them to go." Pelion looked at the display, feeling slightly sandbagged. But the Grand Admiral's logic tracked clean. "Kashyyyk?" "Kashyyyk," Thrawn confirmed. "They know they can't evade our Nogri forever, and so they've decided to surround her with Wookiees, for all the good it will do them." Pelion felt his lip twitch. He'd been aboard one of the ships that had been sent to Kashyyyk to capture Wookiees for the Empire's slave trade. "It may not be as easy as it sounds, Admiral," he cautioned. "Kashyyyk's ecology can best be described as a layered death trap, and the Wookiees themselves are extremely capable fighters." "So are the Nogri," Thrawn countered coldly. "Now, what of Skywalker?" His vector away from Athiga was consistent with a course toward Jomark, Pelion told him. Of course, he could easily have altered it once he was out of range of our probes. "He's going there," Thrawn said, lip twisting in a tight smile. "Our Jedi Master has said so, hasn't he?" The Grand Admiral glanced at the chrono on his display board. We'll leave for Jomark immediately. How much lead time will we have? A minimum of 4 days, assuming that Skywalker's X-Wing hasn't been overly modified. More than that, depending on how many stopovers he has to make on the way. He'll make no stopovers, Thrawn said. Jedi use a hibernation state for trips of such length. For our purposes, though, 4 days will be quite adequate. He straightened in his chair and touched a switch. The command room's lights came back up, the holographic sculptures fading away. We'll need 2 more ships, he told Pelion. An interdictor cruiser to bring Skywalker out of hyperspace where we want him, and some kind of freighter, an expendable one preferably. Pelion blinked. Expendable, sir? Expendable, Captain. We're going to set up the attack as a pure accident, an opportunity that will seem to have arisen while we were investigating a suspicious freighter for rebellion munitions. He cocked an eyebrow. That way, you see, we retain the option of turning him over to Cabalth if we choose to do so, without even Skywalker realizing he was actually ambushed. Understood, sir, Pelion said. With your permission, I'll get the Chimera underway. He turned to go. And paused. Halfway across the room, one of the sculptures had not disappeared with the others. Sitting all alone in its globe of light, it slowly writhed on its pedestal like a wave in some bizarre alien ocean. Yes, Thrawn said from behind him. That one is indeed real. It's very interesting, Pelion managed. The sculpture was strangely hypnotic. Isn't it? Thrawn agreed, his voice sounding almost wistful. It was my one failure out on the fringes. The one time when understanding a race's art gave me no insight at all into its psyche. At least, not at the time. Now I believe I'm finally beginning to understand them. I'm sure that will prove useful in the future, Pelion offered diplomatically. I doubt it, Thrawn said in that same wistful voice. I wound up destroying their world. Pelion swallowed. Yes, sir, he said, starting again for the door. He winced only a little as he passed the sculpture. Chapter 16. There was no dreaming in the Jedi hibernation trance. No dreaming, no consciousness, virtually no awareness of the outside world. It was very much like a coma, in fact, except for one interesting anomaly. Despite the absence of true consciousness, Luke's time sense still somehow managed to function. He didn't understand it exactly, but it was something he'd learned to recognize and use. It was that time sense, coupled with R2's frantic gurgling in the foggy distance, that was his first hint something was wrong. All right, R2, I'm awake, he reassured the droid, as he worked his way back toward consciousness. Blinking the gummy feeling out of his eyes, he gave the instruments a quick scan. The readings confirmed what his time sense had already told him. The X-Wing had come out of hyperspace, nearly 20 light-years short of Jomark. The proximity indicator registered 2 ships, practically on top of him ahead, with a third off to one side in the distance. Still blinking, he raised his head for a look. And with a rush of adrenaline came fully awake. Directly ahead of him was what looked like a light freighter, a blazing overload in its engine section visible through crumpled and half-vaporized hull plates. Beyond it, looming like a dark cliff face, was an Imperial Star Destroyer. Anger, fear, aggression. The dark side of the Force, are they? With an effort, Luke forced down his fear. The freighter was between him and the Star Destroyer. Concentrating on their larger prey, the Imperials might not even have noticed his arrival. "Let's get out of here, R2," he said, keying the controls back to manual and swinging the X-Wing hard around. The etheric rudder whined in protest with the turn. "Unidentified starfighter," a harsh voice boomed from the speaker. "This is the Imperial Star Destroyer Chimera. Transmit your identification code and state your business." So much for hoping he wouldn't be noticed. In the distance now, Luke could see what it was that had yanked the X-Wing out of hyperspace. The third ship was an interdictor cruiser, the Empire's favorite tool for keeping opponents from jumping to light speed. Obviously, they'd been lying in wait for the freighter. It was just his bad luck that he'd run across the interdictor's projected mass shadow and been kicked out of hyperspace along with it. The freighter. Closing his eyes briefly with concentration, Luke reached out with the Force, trying to discover whether it was a Republic ship, a neutral, or even a pirate that the Chimera had caught. But there was no hint of any life aboard. Either the crew had escaped, or else they'd already been taken prisoner. Either way, there was nothing Luke could do for them now. "R2, find me the nearest edge of that interdictor's gravity wave cone," he ordered, throwing the X-Wing into a stomach-churning downward drop that even the acceleration compensator couldn't quite handle. If he could keep the freighter directly between him and the Star Destroyer, he might be able to get out of range before they could bring a tractor beam to bear. "Unidentified starfighter," the harsh voice was starting to get angry. "I repeat, transmit your identification code or prepare to be detained." "Should have brought one of Han's false ID codes with me," Luke muttered to himself. "R2, where's that edge estimate?" The droid beeped, and a diagram appeared on the computer scope. "That far, huh?" Luke murmured. "Well, nothing to do but go for it. Hang on." "Unidentified starfighter." The rest of the harangue was drowned out by the roar of the drive as Luke abruptly kicked the ship to full power. Almost lost in the noise was R2's questioning trilling. "No, I want the deflector shields down," Luke shouted back. "We need the extra speed." He didn't add that if the Star Destroyer was really serious about vaporizing them, the presence or absence of shields wouldn't matter much at this range anyway. But R2 probably already knew that. But if the Imperials didn't seem interested in vaporizing him out of hand, neither were they willing to just let him go. On the rear scope, he could see the Star Destroyer moving up and over the damaged freighter, trying to get clear of its interference. Luke threw a quick look at the proximity indicator. He was still within tractor beam range, and at their current relative speeds would remain so for the next couple of minutes. What he needed was some way to distract or blind them. "R2, I need a fast reprogramming on one of the proton torpedoes," he called. "I want to drop it at zero delta V, then have it turn around and head straight aft. No sensors or homing codes either. I want it to go out cold. Can you do that?" There was an affirmative beep. "Good. As soon as it's ready, give me a warning and then let it go." He turned his attention back to the rear scope, gave the X-Wing's course a slight readjustment. With its guidance sensors in their normal active state, the torpedo would be subject to the Star Destroyer's impressive array of jamming equipment. Going out cold like this would limit the Imperial's response to trying to shoot it down with laser fire. The flip side of that, of course, was that if it wasn't aimed very accurately, it would shoot right past its intended target without even a twitch. R2 beeped, and with a slight lurch, the torpedo was away. Luke watched it go, reaching out with the Force to give it a slight realignment tap. and a second later, with a spectacular multiple flash of sympathetic detonations, the freighter blew up. Luke looked at the proximity indicator, mentally crossing his fingers. Almost out of range now. If the debris from the freighter could screen off the tractor beam for a few more seconds, they should make it. R2 warbled a warning. Luke glanced at the translation, then at the long-range scope, and felt his stomach tighten. R2 warbled again, more insistently this time. "I see it, R2," Luke growled. It was, of course, the obvious tactic for the Imperials to employ. With the freighter no longer of any interest whatsoever, the interdictor was changing position, swinging around to try to bring its huge gravity field projectors more fully to bear on the escaping X-Wing. Luke watched as the cone-shaped field area angled across the scope. "Hang on, R2," he called. And again, too abruptly for the compensators to totally negate, he swung the X-Wing into a right-angle turn, blasting laterally to their original course. From behind him came a shocked screech. "Quiet, R2. I know what I'm doing," he told the droid. Off to starboard now, the Star Destroyer was belatedly trying to shift its massive bulk, pivoting to track Luke's maneuver. And, for the first time since the beginning of the encounter, flashes of laser fire began lancing out. Luke made a quick decision. Speed alone wasn't going to save him now, and a near miss could end the contest right here and now. "Deflectors up, R2, he instructed the droid, giving his full attention to his best evasive maneuvering. "Give me a balance between shield power and speed." R2 beeped a response, and there was a slight drop in engine noise as the shields began drawing power. They were going slower, but so far the gamble seemed to be working. Caught off balance by Luke's right-angle maneuver, the interdictor was now rotating in the wrong direction, its gravity beam sweeping across Luke's previous course instead of tracking the current one. Its commander was obviously trying to correct that mistake, but the sheer inertia of the ship's massive gravity generators was on Luke's side. If he could stay out of the Star Destroyer's range for another few seconds, he'd be out of the beam and free to escape to hyperspace. "Stand by for light speed," he told R2. "Don't worry about direction. We can do a short hop and set things up more carefully once we're clear." R2 acknowledged. And, without warning, Luke was slammed hard against his harness. The Star Destroyer's tractor beam had them. R2 shrilled in dismay, but Luke had no time to comfort the droid now. His straight-line course had suddenly become an arc, a sort of pseudo-orbit with the Star Destroyer playing the role of planet at its center. Unlike a true orbit, though, this one wasn't stable. And as soon as the Imperials got another beam focused on him, the circle would quickly degenerate into a tight inward spiral. A spiral whose endpoint would be inside the Star Destroyer's hangar bay. He dropped the shields, throwing full power once again to the drive, knowing full well it was most likely a futile gesture. And he was right. For a second the beam seemed to falter, but it quickly caught back up with him. Such a relatively minor change in speed was too small to foul up the beam's tracking equipment. But if he could find a way to arrange a more major change in speed... "Unidentified starfighter," the harsh voice was back, unmistakably gloating this time. "You have no chance of escape. Further efforts will merely damage your vehicle. You are ordered to power down and prepare to dock." Luke clenched his teeth. This was going to be dangerous, but he'd run out of choices. And he had heard stories of this working at least once before. Somewhere. "R2, we're going to try something tricky," he called to the droid. "On my signal, I want you to reverse trigger the acceleration compensator. Full power, and bypass the cutoffs if you have to." Something warbled from the control panel, and he risked a quick look at the scope. His curving arc had brought him right to the edge of the interdictor's gravity projection. R2, now! And with a scream of horribly stressed electronics, the X-Wing came to a sudden dead stop. There wasn't even enough time for Luke to wonder what aboard his ship could possibly have made a scream like that before he was again thrown, even harder this time, against his harness. His thumbs, ready on the firing buttons, jabbed down hard, sending a pair of proton torpedoes lancing forward. Simultaneously, he pulled the X-Wing upward. The Star Destroyer's tractor beam, tracking him along his path, had momentarily gotten lost by his sudden maneuver. If the computers guiding that lock would now be considerate enough to latch onto the proton torpedoes instead of him... And suddenly, the torpedoes were gone, leaving behind only a wisp of their exhaust trail to show that they'd been snatched off their original course. The gamble had succeeded. The Star Destroyer was now steadily pulling in the wrong target. "We're free," he snapped to R2, throwing full power to the drive. "Get ready for light speed." The droid trilled something, but Luke had no time to look down at the computer scope for the translation. Realizing their error, and recognizing there was insufficient time to re-establish a tractor lock, the Imperials had apparently decided to go for a straight kill. All the Star Destroyer's batteries seemed to open up at once, and Luke suddenly found himself trying to dodge a virtual sandstorm of laser fire. Forcing himself to relax, he let the Force flow through him, allowing it to guide his hands on the controls the way it did his lightsaber. The ship jumped once as a shot got through. In his peripheral vision, he saw the tip of his dorsal starboard laser cannon flash and disappear into a cloud of superheated plasma. A near miss burned past overhead. Another, closer, scorched a line across the transparasteel canopy. Another warble came from the scope. They were clear of the interdictor's gravity shadow. "Go!" Luke shouted to R2. And with a second, even more nerve-wrenching electronic scream from behind him, the sky ahead abruptly turned to star lines. They'd made it. For what seemed like a small eternity, Thrawn gazed out the viewport, staring at the spot where Skywalker's X-Wing had been when it had vanished. Surreptitiously, Pelion watched him, wondering tautly when the inevitable explosion would come. With half an ear, he listened to the damage control reports coming from the number 4 tractor beam projector, carefully not getting himself involved with the cleanup. The destruction of one of the Chimera's 10 projectors was a relatively minor loss. Skywalker's escape was not. Thrawn stirred and turned around. Pelion tensed. "Come with me, Captain," the Grand Admiral said quietly, striding away down the bridge command walkway. "Yes, sir," Pelion murmured, falling into step behind him. The stories of how Darth Vader had dealt with subordinates' failures running through his mind. The bridge was uncommonly quiet as Thrawn led the way to the aft stairway and descended into the starboard crew pit. He walked past the crewers at their consoles, past the officers standing painfully erect behind them, and came to a halt at the control station for the starboard tractor beams. "Your name?" he said, his voice excruciatingly calm. "Chris Peterson, sir," the young man seated at the console answered, his eyes wary. "You were in charge of the tractor beam during our engagement with the starfighter." It was a statement, not a question. "Yes, sir, but what happened wasn't my fault." Thrawn's eyebrows arched just a bit. "Explain." Peterson started to gesture to the side, changed his mind in mid-motion. The target did something with his acceleration compensator that killed his velocity vector. I'm aware of the facts, Thrawn cut in. I'm waiting to hear why his escape wasn't your fault. I was never properly trained for such an occurrence, sir, Peterson said, a flicker of defiance touching his eyes. The computer lost the lock, but seemed to pick it up again right away. There was no way for me to know it had really picked up something else until... Until the proton torpedoes detonated against the projector? Peterson held his gaze evenly. Yes, sir. For a long moment, Thrawn studied him. Who is your officer? He asked at last. Peterson's eyes shifted to the right. Ensign Colclasure, sir. Slowly, deliberately, Thrawn turned to the tall man standing rigidly at attention with his back to the walkway. You are in charge of this man? Colclasure swallowed visibly. Yes, sir, he said. Was his training also your responsibility? Yes, sir, Colclasure said again. Did you, during that training, run through any scenarios similar to what just happened? I don't remember, sir, the ensign admitted. The standard training package does include scenarios concerning loss of lock and subsequent re-establishment confirmation. Thrawn threw a brief glance back down at Peterson. Did you recruit him as well, ensign?
No, sir. He was a conscript.
Does that make him less worthy of your training time than a normal enlistee?
No, sir.
Coclasure's eyes flicked to Peterson. I've always tried to treat my subordinates equally. I see. Thrawn considered a moment, then half turned to look past Pelion's shoulder. Ruch? Pelion started as Ruch brushed silently past him. He hadn't realized the Nogri had followed them down. Thrawn waited until Ruch was standing at his side, then turned back to Colclasure. Do you know the difference between an error and a mistake, ensign? The entire bridge had gone deathly still. Colclasure swallowed again, his face starting to go pale. No, sir. Anyone can make an error, ensign. But that error doesn't become a mistake until you refuse to correct it. He raised a finger and almost lazily pointed. Pelion never even saw Ruch move. Peterson certainly never had time to scream. From farther down the crew pit came the sound of someone trying valiantly not to be sick. Thrawn glanced over Pelion's shoulder again and gestured, and the silence was further broken by the sound of a pair of stormtroopers coming forward. Dispose of it, the Grand Admiral ordered them, turning away from Peterson's crumpled body and pinning Colclasure with a stare. The error, ensign, he told the other softly, has now been corrected. You may begin training a replacement. He held Colclasure's eyes another heartbeat. Then, seemingly oblivious to the tension around him, he turned back to Pelion. I want a full technical, tactical readout on the last few seconds of that encounter, Captain, he said, all calm business again. I am particularly interested in his light speed vector. I have it all here, sir, a lieutenant spoke up a bit hesitantly, stepping forward to offer the Grand Admiral a data pad. Thank you. Thrawn glanced at it briefly, handed it to Pelion. We'll have him, Captain, he said, starting back down the crew pit toward the stairway. Very soon now, we'll have him. Yes, sir, Pelion agreed cautiously, hurrying to catch up with the other.
I'm sure it's just a matter of time. Thrawn raised an eyebrow.
You misunderstand me, he said mildly. I mean that literally. He's out there right now, not very far away. And, he smiled slyly at Pelion, he's helpless.
Pelion frowned. I don't understand, sir.
That maneuver he used has an interesting side effect I suspect he didn't know about, the Grand Admiral explained. Backfiring an acceleration compensator like that does severe damage to the adjoining hyperdrive. A light year away, no farther, and it will fail completely. All we have to do is make a search along that vector, or persuade others to do our searching for us, and he'll be ours. You follow?
Yes, sir, Pelion said. Shall I contact the rest of the fleet?
Thrawn shook his head. Preparing for the Sluice Van attack is the fleet's top priority at the moment. No, I think we'll subcontract this one out. I want you to send messages to all the major smuggling chiefs whose groups operate in this area. Brask, Karda, Parta, any others we have on file. Use their private frequencies and encrypt codes. A little reminder of how much we know about each of them should help ensure their cooperation. Give them Skywalker's hyperspace vector and offer a bounty of 30,000 for his capture.
Yes, sir.
Pelion glanced back down the crew pit at the activity still going on around the tractor beam station.
Sir, if you knew that Skywalker's escape was only temporary...
The Empire is at war, Captain, the Grand Admiral said, his voice cold. We cannot afford the luxury of men whose minds are so limited they cannot adapt to unexpected situations. He looked significantly at Rook, then turned those glowing eyes back on Pelion. Carry out your orders, Captain. Skywalker will be ours, alive or otherwise.
Chapter 17. In front of Luke, the scopes and displays glowed softly as the diagnostic messages, most of them bordered in red, scrolled past. Beyond the displays, through the canopy, he could see the X-Wing's nose, lit faintly by the sheen of distant starlight. Beyond that were the stars themselves, blazing all around him with cold brilliance. And that was all. No sun, no planets, no asteroids, no cometary bodies, no warships, transports, satellites, or probes. Nothing. He and R2 were stranded, very literally, in the middle of nowhere. The computer's diagnostic package came to an end. R2, he called, what have you got? From behind him came a distinctly mournful electronic moan, and the droid's reply appeared on the computer scope. That bad, huh? R2 moaned again, and the computer's summary was replaced by the droid's own assessment of their situation. It wasn't good. Luke's reverse triggering of the acceleration compensator had caused an unanticipated feedback surge into both hyperdrive motivators. Not enough to fry them on the spot, but scorching them badly enough to cause sudden failure 10 minutes into their escape. At the point four the ship had been doing at the time, that translated into approximately half a light year of distance. Just for good measure, the same power surge had also completely crystallized the subspace radio antenna. In other words, Luke said, we can't leave, we aren't likely to be found, and we can't call for help. Does that about sum it up?
R2 beeped an addition. Right, Luke sighed. And we can't stay here. Not for long, anyway.
Luke rubbed a hand across his chin, forcing back the sense of dread gnawing at him. Giving in to fear would only rob him of the ability to think, and that was the last thing he could afford to lose at this point. "All right," he said slowly. "Try this. We take the hyperdrive motivators off both engines and see if we can salvage enough components to put together a single functional one. If we can, we remount it somewhere in the middle of the aft fuselage where it can handle both engines. Maybe where the S-foil servo actuator is now. We don't need that to get home. Possible?" R2 whistled thoughtfully. "I'm not asking if it'll be easy," Luke said patiently as the droid's response came up. "Just if it would be possible." Another whistle, another pessimistic message. "Well, let's give it a try anyway," Luke told him, unstrapping his restraints and trying to wriggle around in the cramped confines of the cockpit. If he pulled off the back of the ejection seat, he would be able to get into the cargo compartment and the tools stored there. R2 warbled something else. "Don't worry, I'm not going to get stuck," Luke assured him, changing his mind and reaching for the in-cockpit pouches instead. The gloves and helmet seals for its flight suit were stored there. It'd be just as easy at this point to gear himself for vacuum and then get into the cargo compartment through its underside hatch. "If you want to be helpful, you might pull up the maintenance specs and find out exactly how I go about getting one of those motivators out. And cheer up, will you? You're starting to sound like 3PO. R2 was still jabbering indignantly over that characterization when the last of Luke's helmet seals cut off the sound. But he did sound less frightened. It took nearly 2 hours for Luke to get past all the other cables and tubing in the way and remove the port engine hyperdrive motivator from its socket. It took less than a minute more to discover that R2's earlier pessimism had been justified. "It's riddled with cracks," Luke told the droid grimly, turning the bulky box over in his hands. "The whole shield casing. Just hairlines, really. You can barely see some of them. But they run most of the length of the sides." R2 gave a soft gurgle, a comment which required no translation. Luke hadn't done a lot of X-wing maintenance, but he knew enough to recognize that without an intact superconducting shield, a hyperdrive motivator was little more than a box of interconnected spare parts. "Let's not give up yet," he reminded R2. "If the other motivator's casing is all right, we may still be in business." Collecting his toolkit, feeling inordinately clumsy in zero-G freefall, he made his way under the X-Wing's fuselage to the starboard engine. It took only a few minutes to remove the proper access cover and tie back some of the interfering cables. Then, trying to get both his faceplate and his glow rod together in the opening without blinding himself, he peered inside. This book is continued on cassette number 6, side 1.